What exactly it means, we're still looking at. I can't really say much more than that right now.
A judge rejects the amended redistricting plan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the governor's oil tax bill gets a cool reception in the Senate Resources Committee.
If we're serious about this, and we should be, because this is the economy of our state, this isn't the way to do it. And we all know it's going to end in a train wreck, and now it's just a matter of who gets to be blamed for it.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Association of Alaska School Boards believes in investing in early childhood development. It can produce great dividends for kids and our state. More information at aasb.org. This message sponsored by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
A state superior court judge has sent an amended redistricting plan back to the Alaska Redistricting Board. Fairbanks Judge Michael McConaughey ruled today that the board must draw a redistricting plan solely compliant with the Alaska Constitution, requiring the board to make findings of fact sufficient to allow the courts to independently measure each district against constitutional standards. On April 11th, the board filed the amended plan with the Superior Court in compliance with a March Alaska Supreme Court order. But seven groups have filed suit against the amended plan, all saying the plan does not comply with the so-called HICL process, which ensures the board draw up a reapportionment plan based on the requirements of the Alaska Constitution. Redistricting Board Attorney Michael White says Judge McConaughey's view of the HICL plan is not the same as the board's.
He had a different interpretation of what the mandated HICL process was from the Supreme Court than we did. So we're still analyzing exactly what that means. He hasn't thrown out anything yet. He just said, I still don't think you followed the right process, so go back and comply with the first part of the process again.
White says the board has to consider whether or not to take today's decision to the state Supreme Court. The board does not meet again until Tuesday to make that decision. White says the board is still looking at what McConaughey ruling means.
It made no individual rulings on anything. It just all has to do with the process. The Supreme Court said, you didn't follow this process that was in this footnote in the HICL case from 20 years ago. Go do that. So the board went back, believed that they followed that process correctly. The trial court disagreed with the board's interpretation of what that process required.
Today's ruling comes a little more than 5 weeks after the state Supreme Court remanded parts of the board's original redistricting plan back to Superior Court, ruling that the board draw up a redistricting plan in compliance with high court guidelines. The Alaska Supreme Court ruled today that a controversial 2008 citizens' initiative in Sitka was legal and should have gone before voters. The decision reverses a lower court ruling. The proposed initiative was seen by many as a way to control further development at Sitka's former pulp mill site, including a possible cruise ship dock. But the litigation doesn't mention ships at all. The underlying issues may be much larger. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
A group called Sitkins for Responsible Government proposed a ballot initiative in the summer of 2008 that would have required any disposal of city real estate worth over $500,000 to be approved by voters. Current municipal code, in fact, already requires a public vote for large land disposals, but exempts sales or leases at Sawmill Cove Industrial Park. Property sales there require only the approval of an appointed board and then an assembly resolution. Sitkins for Responsible Government sought to change that through a citizen initiative and to bring land disposals at Sawmill Cove into line with the code governing all other city land transactions. But the initiative never made it to the ballot. The municipal clerk's office, under the guidance of municipal attorney Teresa Hillhouse, refused to certify the initiative twice. Both times, the rejections included lengthy arguments against the proposed initiative language provided by a law firm hired to consult with the city. Sitkins for Responsible Government sought and won an injunction in Sitka Superior Court, which allowed signature gathering to occur, But Judge David George ultimately ruled that the informal group organized by Mike Lippman and Jeff Farver had no legal standing, and he upheld the city's refusal to certify the initiative. Lippman and Farver, represented by Juneau attorney Joe Geldhoff, appealed and won. The Alaska Supreme Court found in favor of Sitkins for Responsible Government in every aspect of the case. Justices wrote, "As the sponsors persuasively argue, their initiative would do no more than bring disposals of municipal land in the Sawmill Cove area into conformity with Sitka ordinances." The justices also saw problems with Teresa Hillhouse's legal rationale for refusing to certify the initiative in the first place. The justices wrote, "If Sitka believes there is a conflict between municipal code and the Sitka charter, the city should amend either its charter or the ordinance." Geldhoff, the attorney for Lippman and Farver, called the Supreme Court's opinion well-reasoned. He said his clients think Sitka residents ought to have the right to take a look at their initiative and vote on it. The Supreme Court has remanded the case back to Judge George in Sitka, where Municipal Attorney Hillhouse is planning another strategy to limit voter control of land management at Sawmill Cove. In a written statement, Hillhouse reports that the same justices who handed her this defeat recently ruled that voters in Kenai did not have the power to veto capital projects over $1 million. She'll draw the attention of the Sitka Superior Court to this ruling in the hope that it will resolve the issue in the city's favor. Reporting in Anchorage with help from Ed Ronco, I'm Robert Woolsey.
No new support for Governor Parnell's oil tax plan has shown up in the Senate during the special legislative session that began this week. The bill now before the Resources Committee has actually gotten bad reviews from those who previously supported the administration. Anchorage Republican Liesl McGuire said the bill the governor introduced on Wednesday was, quote, half-baked. As a member of the Resources and Finance Committees in the Senate, McGuire saw two plans emerge during the regular session this year, and she voted against both of them. But in a Resources meeting today, she advised the Revenue Commissioner, Brian Butcher, and his staff to come up with their own tax plan and listen to their own advisors.
It's frustrating because you're in a position where you're trying to sell a bill that I just don't feel like you understand the ins and the outs of it. And I think that's an unfortunate position for you to be in, both of you to be in. I think it's an unfortunate position for us to be in. And I think it's a tremendous waste of government money and time.
McGuire said she still remains in alignment with the governor's idea that the state should have a more competitive tax regime.
I make these comments as a friendly voice to say that if we're serious about this, and we should be, because this is the economy of our state, this isn't the way to do it. And we all know it's going to end in a train wreck, and now it's just a matter of who gets to be blamed for it. And I think that's silly.
Butcher explained the governor's bill reflects an attempt to work within the structure and concepts of the bills with which the legislature was already familiar. And later in the meeting, he said the oil industry needs to provide factual information to support their indications there will be more investment with lower taxes.
We can lay out what we think the problem is. We can lay out what we believe the solution is. But ultimately, companies are going to have to come forward and make a compelling case as to why passing this makes sense. And government isn't going to play the major role in that piece.
Resources Chairman Joe Pascavan said he will not schedule any other hearings on the bill until the Department of Revenue provides documents supporting it. He suggested the next meeting will likely be sometime in the middle of next week. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the University of Alaska Anchorage works to stop violence.
By not addressing sexual assault and sexual harassment issues, the university can be perpetuating gender discrimination on college campuses.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
thanks to attractive gold prices, a slow job market in the lower 48, and a recent reality TV show. More than 100 offshore miners will set up shop in Nome's waters this summer. Recreational mining is regulated by the state, but the city of Nome is moving ahead with developing its own permitting and fee system. KNOM's Ben Matheson has more.
86 recreational mining permits have been approved, with another 14 arriving in the city office Tuesday. That's double the number of last summer. Those permits are in addition to the lease tracts sold last fall. 6 weeks before the open water season, the city is looking to regulate and potentially limit mining through the city's own permit process. The Nome Planning Commission discussed the draft ordinance on Tuesday. As written, the new permit requires a non-refundable $1,000 fee. The City Council boosted it from $750 to $1,000, but the Planning Commission recommended a lower fee, as well as requiring commercial miners on city property to pay as well. The ultimate impact of miners on city resources and services is still unknown, but city staff say that the money raised through the permit could improve the city's ability to enforce. City Manager Josie Banky.
What we saw last year was a real strain on our city services, whether it was search and rescue, the police department, and we spent a great deal of time and effort, which kind of left us with our head scratching, saying, you know, how can we help, you know, these users, you know, help pay for city services and contribute that way.
The State Department of Natural Resources at this point has not suggested limiting the number of permits. With 100 dredges on the way, the city could sidestep the state and limit the number of permits it issues. City Attorney Brooks Chandler and Commissioner Randy Romanesco say the DNR and city are determining Nome's capacity in different ways.
You know, how many can you fit inside the area? That's their concept of what the limit is right now. That's DNR's concept.
Yeah, and that's not the limiting factor in this equation. I mean, it's the space when you get to the freshwater side of the spit, and our ability to run a major harbor that supports fisheries, fuels.
The Port of Nome has been filled to the brink the past few summers, and this year will likely be sending dredges up the Snake River to dock. The Port Commission will be working in the next week to determine a hard number of vessels that puts the harbor at its breaking point. The city also wants to address safety concerns through the permit. Harbor Master Joy Baker says the small hand-built dredges are primarily considered recreational, and all the Coast Guard can do is recommend they register with the state and have certain safety equipment on board.
He said because most of this is recreational, also cracks, they don't have a regulation that addresses that, unfortunately. They're still looking at it, but they said most what they can do, what they're going to do this summer is education and outreach and try to keep these guys safe. But it's only the commercial outfits that they can actually use a hammer on.
The city's attorney says Nome could require certain safety equipment, like marine VHF radios or divers' flags. He added that the city council can pass language limiting the hours of operation, for example, from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Given the unlimited daylight and the short open water season, the commission removed any reference to hours of operation. The commission also put forth a suggestion to look into requiring mufflers on some dredges to control noise at late hours. Another unanswered question has to do with the enforcement of city sales tax for gold sold within the city. The city could require documentation showing that the miners charged 5% sales tax and filed returns in order to get their permits renewed next year. In the ordinance as written, miners would be required to keep records of all sales of gold extracted and sold in or out of Nome. The city would be able to inspect the records. In addition to the small-scale recreational miners, 84 lease tracts were sold last fall in a $9 million DNR sale. Nome is expecting $5 million jack-up dredges, more excavator operations, as well as exploration done by a South African company, Anglo Gold. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
Developers of a proposed mine at the Herbert Glacier believe there's at least 245,000 ounces of gold. That's based on an independent resource estimate of exploratory drilling over the last 2 years and recent assays. The Herbert Glacier area is being jointly developed by Grand Portage Resources Limited and Quitara Resources, both of Vancouver, British Columbia. Tom Patton, CEO and president of Quitara, hinted that the largest estimate is only a partial picture of Herbert Glacier's potential.
We think that this thing has got potential for, you know, 1 million plus ounces of high-grade gold.
Patton made the comments during a Wall Street analysts conference last week before Monday's release of the resource estimate for 2 out of 4 potential veins. The total resource is estimated at more than 1.5 million metric tons. If those estimates are correct, then the value of the gold at today's market prices would be approximately $404 million.
We got interested in this thing just because of the address. Juneau, after the First World War, was the top gold number one gold producing district in the world. This Herbert Glacier deposit was not discovered at that time because it was under the Herbert Glacier, which has since receded.
Patton told analysts that his company expects to spend about $700,000 for additional work at Herbert Glacier this year. Rates of domestic violence and sexual assault in Alaska are some of the highest in the country. In order to help raise awareness about domestic violence and sexual assault, UAA is taking steps to educate students and the larger Anchorage community about how to stop the abuse of others and themselves. APRN's Heather Arono reports.
A report compiled by the UAA Dean of Students Office documents 6 incidents in the last fiscal year involving domestic violence, either between roommates in the residential halls or between students in a relationship. UAA is in the process of ramping up education about sexual assault and domestic violence. Michael Vitava, Assistant Director of Student Conduct, says UAA wants to dedicate more resources towards sexual assault awareness.
We want to stop those behaviors from occurring. We want to prevent their recurrence, and if there's been someone who's been harmed as a result of sexual harassment or sexual assault, we want to do everything we can to make them whole.
Vitava says UAA recently determined that it has more responsibility to raise awareness about sexual assault due to the requirements of Title IX. The 1972 Educational Amendment bans gender discrimination in regard to educational programs and activities. It is more commonly applied to athletic opportunities for students, but a letter issued by the U.S. Department of Education encourages schools and college campuses to share a broader interpretation of Title IX.
Because when you think about it, sexual harassment issues and sexual assault issues happen more often to women than men. Knowing that, by not addressing sexual assault and sexual harassment issues, the university can be perpetuating gender discrimination on college campuses.
Vitava says UAA is in the process of hiring 2 new Title IX investigators who will also serve as educational trainers on sexual assault issues.
That means helping students understand what sexual harassment is and helping students understand what sexual assault is. To be able to understand what sexual assault and sexual misconduct are, students need to be educated about what consent means, because I think there are quite a few misconceptions about what it means to have consent, to engage in sexual activity.
Vitava says UAA will be launching a marketing campaign in the fall encouraging students to report sexual assault and sexual harassment to the Dean of Students' Office. UAA will also set aside funding to help students recovering from the trauma of sexual assault. In Anchorage, I'm Heather Arono.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Emily Schwing. This week on AK, a journey. Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood leaders made a unique boat trip through the waters of the Inside Passage this month. Their voyage harkened back to the days when local camp officials from towns and villages around the region would travel on fishing boats to attend Grand Camp conventions. The Brotherhood was founded a century ago, followed a year later by the Sisterhood. So this journey had special meaning for the cultural and civil rights organizations. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein caught up with them when they stopped in Petersburg.
A celebration awaited the 65-foot motor vessel Christian when she arrived at Petersburg South Harbor earlier this month. Local members of the Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood came to drum and sing her in, a traditional welcome. Sisterhood Grand President Mary Brown was among the passengers who spoke at a well-attended potluck later.
When we were seeing you gathering, we said, there they are, there they are, they're up on the docks. We were excited and so pleased to be welcomed into your community.
The trip started in Kluwak earlier this month and went on to Wrangell before the stop in Petersburg. For Brown, it was reminiscent of her youth.
I remember our A&B and A&S members leaving on a same boat to go to the convention because they couldn't afford to fly. And I remember them drumming and singing as they're leaving the docks. And then I got to travel with my mother to a Salvation Army Congress, and I remembered pulling into Cake, and the Salvation Army people on the boat were drumming and singing. And then they stopped, and I could hear the drums coming from Cake as the boat was going in, and it was just full of people.
And that was what Brown envisioned for this trip. She called it spiritually uplifting. It gave her energy. She was not alone.
It just warms my heart to see this boat here and see the people here.
Petersburg A&B Camp President Ross Lanook III was unable to go on the voyage, but he was excited to greet the MV Christian with song and drum. The arrival reminded him of his parents, who were also members of the A&B and A&S. Nanook said he's always been involved with the organization. He said it's in his blood.
I've always lived the Native life, you know, growing up with my grandparents and my parents. We subsisted, as they call it, you know, and we lived off the land. I grew up on salmon and seal and deer and all the foods, wild celery, seaweed, berries, everything you can find around here. My grandparents took us out and we picked it.
According to Sisterhood Executive Committee member and former Grand President Mary Guthrie of Kluwak, Christian faith is the foundation of A&B, A&S, and that faith runs deep.
In the old timers, when I first started going to convention in 1984, would stand up, and this is what they used to say at every convention, is if you cut open my chest, you will find A&S or A&B engraved on the heart. And that's how I feel, and I'm real happy to say that, and I've got full trust in the fact that this organization shall live and not die.
A&B and A&S are probably best known for their central role in the historic struggle for Native civil rights and against discrimination in Alaska. That mission continues today. Cecilia Lopez-Tavalero is an executive committee member of the A&S and former grand president. She brought along a copy of the newly shared constitution that the Brotherhood and Sisterhood adopted together at last year's Grand Camp Convention.
The mission of the A&B and A&S is to better the lives of Native people and their families, to fight for civil rights and land rights for all Native people, to share the cultural knowledge, wisdom, and artistic beauty of Native tribal societies, and to strive for a spirit of brotherhood and sisterhood among all people.
Bringing back more Native culture and education to Petersburg is key for local A&S Camp President Brenda Louise, who also serves as the Sisterhood's Grand Sergeant-at-Arms. She got on the boat in Petersburg.
And being able to go on this trip to Cake, Huna, and Goon, where culture has been alive and strong for a long time, is very exciting. I'm excited about learning new things. I'm excited about bringing it back to our camp. And I'm excited about the company that we have on the boat.
The Alaska Native Brotherhood will hold its 100th Grand Camp Convention this fall, and next fall it's the Sisterhood Centennial. For AK, I'm Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. Today we're heading to Lime Village, a tiny community directly west of Anchorage.
Hey,
My name is Ursula Graham. I'm the tribal administrator for the Lyme Village Traditional Council. We're about 160 miles west of Anchorage, located on the Stony River. We're a pretty small little Athabascan, Dena'ina Athabascan community. Yeah, it's just a nice, quiet little place. It's kind of shrinking, I guess. It used to be about 44 to 45 before the school closed. And then, actually, I just did a census count, and we have 29 people here. Dead to some people, but yeah, I think the school closing definitely was a blow to the community. But it, you know, we're doing what we need to, and moving forward. We have a lot of projects going on. We're really into recycling. We have a new, the phone call that I just got was from a guy that we may be getting an incinerator from. So our landfill is being cleaned up, and we have a battery collection area, an e-waste collection area. Right now there's duck hunting. We just got done piling up a bunch of wood because it's easier to get it in the winter and nice to get it in the spring because it's warm. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous here. We have the Alaska Range just to the west, and then we have some rolling hills around us, Lyme Hills. That's where we get our name, Lyme Village.
Ursula Graham is the tribal administrator for the Lyme Village. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Matt Lichtenstein, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Emily Schwing.
And finally tonight, a correction. Last night in a story about film tax credits, we said legislator Anna Faircloth represents Wasilla. In fact, her district is Eagle River. We apologize for the error. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Robert Woolsey in Anchorage and Matt Miller in Juneau. Emily Schwing was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Heather Arono from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Andy Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska, one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.